House of Comments. I'm your host, Charlotte Henry. Now, this week, my normal partner in crime, Emma Burnell, is away. She is treading the boards and putting on her play, which is very excited. Break a leg, Emma, if you're listening. I thought I'd jump over the other side of the aisle and invite a Conservative on this week. So, Henry Hill, Deputy Editor of Conservative Home, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Now, I ended last week's show, in which I was particularly grumpy following the autumn statement, with a question, which, not surprisingly, neither Emma or I had an answer to, but I'm hoping you might. Henry, what is the point of the Conservative Party at the moment?
So currently, if we try and infer its function from what it actually does on a sort of month-to-month basis, the job of the Conservative Party is to defend the rights and prerogatives and rents of the aging homeowning class in this country at all costs. A slightly less
cynical
answer.
Henry, I don't think that's not what you're meant to say out loud. You said the quiet bit out loud.
Well, happily, Conservative Home is independent of the Conservative Party, which gives us the leeway to describe it accurately. But I think if we step back from that, that is the arch cynical answer. I think the real answer is that the Conservative Party doesn't know. Because there are...
That is what it feels like to an outsider, I have to say.
Yeah, there are at least two viable centre-right movements, potential governments in the Conservative Party at the moment. You have basically something like the Cameroon one, which was much more geared towards the sort of traditional post-Thatcherite Conservative base in the South, much more geared towards middle-class voters, as wealthier voters, more liberal. And then you've got...
Hence why the coalition could see its, you know, see itself to term. You could work with Nick Clegg and Danny Alexander and David Laws quite comfortably, because on many issues, the truth is they didn't seem, their vision of Britain was not very different.
Yeah, absolutely, precisely. And then on the other hand, you've got what, for the sake, and it is only shorthand, it's not a particular, you know, what we might call the red wall version of the Conservative Party, which is a Conservative Party that really leans into the realignment, is built much more on C2DE voters, has a much bigger footprint in the north of England, is much more comfortable with higher levels of public spending. And unlike either of those...
Explain for our listeners the demographic you were just describing, the C2.
Oh, C2DE is basically like, it's basically working class. It's lower income voters. I'm not sufficiently across my sociology that I could give you the precise definitions.
No,
but basically, just... you've got sort of A and B voters, which are your higher income voters, C1 and C2, which is broadly, I think, skilled and unskilled working class, a manual, and then you have D and E. Basically, working class voters would be a broad strokes way of saying it. Now, obviously, that term is contested, which is why I try not to jump around too easily, but that's broadly what I mean. Now, either of those could present a sort of intellectually and politically coherent offer to the nation. The problem is that currently the Conservative Party is trapped between both, because it has not leaned sufficiently into the result of the 2019 election. It's still got lots of MPs who are not comfortable with that kind of Johnsonian spending push. But at the same time, it's sufficiently red wall-y and sufficiently Brexity and sufficiently prepared to make lots of noise about culture war issues that it alienates those more sort of higher income, more liberally inclined voters that David Cameron's invested so much time into wooing. So currently the Conservative Party just doesn't know. As a collective, the Conservative Party doesn't know what it's trying to do. There is no fixed vision, shared vision that spans the party about what sort of United Kingdom it's trying to produce. And because of that, it is instead sort of lurching from crisis to crisis, issue to issue, managing bad things as they happen-ish, but it's not really making any concerted effort to get anywhere. And I think that that's now increasingly obvious with the way that it's governing.
Yeah, I have to say, it is the lack of proactivity that I find most dispiriting, the kind of acceptance of managed decline. And now we could spend a whole show, but we won't, listing Liz Truss's failures and faults. But she did at least have a vision which you could agree with or disagree with, and was, you know, completely failed to execute, to make it, you know, to execute in a way that made that vision possible. But had, you know, an, you know, ideology has become a bit of a loaded phrase, but she did have some level of thinking, so did Kwasi Kwarteng, about what they wanted Britain to look like and how they might improve Britain. As I say, they totally and utterly failed to execute it in any way, made a complete hash of it, and actually made it almost impossible for free market ideas to function anymore. They also made it so that Jeremy Hunt and then Rishi Sunak basically had to overcompensate, I think, and we saw that in the autumn statement, by squeezing things even further just to, you know, to reassure the markets, which, as I think I said last week, markets are people, investors are people. You know, there's not some magic institution out there. A lot of this stuff runs on sentiment. And they did obviously feel they needed to, as I say, I think, rather overcompensate in that technocratic managerial way. So, yes, I think you're right that the Conservative Party does find it in a bind. And, you know, again, not a Conservative Party member like you are, but I, when I saw, first of all, in the first, that big summer leadership election, it was pretty obvious to me that Rishi Sunak was the best candidate for the job. I don't recall who you personally back then. And by the time, you know, this, I rather like Penny Mordaunt for lots of reasons, but it was again fairly obvious that he needed to succeed Liz Truss. And the Conservative Party was just fixing a mistake it had made a few weeks earlier. But I think Sunak and Hunt do need to offer a bit more of a vision than sort of managed decline and we're very sensible and calm. How, I mean, first of all, how do you think about that? And you, I know, speak to many members of the Conservative Party and get correspondence from many members of the Conservative Party. What's the feeling like within the party?
Yeah, so I mean, I don't tend to say who I vote for in internal contests just because, you know, at Conservative Home,
we
can, but it's, yeah, I think you're broadly correct. The fact that Rishi Sunak was the best candidate, I think, doesn't particularly say all that much about Rishi Sunak, because the bar was relatively low. But I think he probably was the stronger, you know, the stronger candidate, especially after the implosion. You know, you absolutely, overcorrection or not, you did need some kind of correction to stop the economy going into sort of absolute panic mode. But yeah, the problem he has is that, again, there's no Sunakism. You know, well, one of the things that I did during the first leadership campaign is all of the candidates put forward prospectus, and I went through Rishi's, and I wrote a piece for Conholme, which now feels completely pointless, being like, here are five policies that Rishi Sunak believes in that you might not have thought about that might be interesting. And, you know, there was some really good stuff in there. There was like Home Office reform, for example, which I'm a huge champion of. And it's all just been completely jettisoned. And I think
instead he brought Suella Braverman straight back.
Instead he brought Suella Braverman. Yeah, precisely. And, you know, I understand it was, you know, bringing Suella back might have been the lesser of two evils if that prevented Boris Johnson getting over the line and forcing a contest. So, you know, politics is politics. You do have to make these kinds of concessions. But nonetheless, you know, I think it would still be a really worthwhile thing for him to do, even if he does only have 2 years left, to commission proper work about overhauling what is a deeply dysfunctional department. But fundamentally, what we've seen in the autumn statement and the overriding sort of animating spirit of what the Conservatives are doing at the moment is it's just deferring difficult decisions. Because the blunt truth is that given where our taxes are, as you say, our taxes are extremely high and public services are extremely bad, which is a really bad mixture. A serious government would be
Not Scandinavia, are we?
Well, we're not
paying high tax for good services.
Yeah, we're genuinely looking like we're going to end up in this really weird position where we're paying Scandinavian taxes for American services, which is just absolutely extraordinary government failure. But ultimately, given that there is only so much money you can actually raise through taxation, realistically, you know, you could maybe get a bit more from a windfall tax here or there, but realistically, the tax burden is already extremely high. If you want to be making sure that key bits of the country are running properly, and that means not just making sure that the NHS has enough money, but making sure that the courts have enough money to actually deliver justice, that the police are actually more than an institution that gives you a crime number for your insurance company, you know, things like this, the basic things, especially if you're the Conservatives, you know, basic law and order stuff is, you can't lose that and then win election. You would genuinely have
especially
to
especially if you're the Conservative Party.
Yeah, absolutely. I can't speak for Labour or the Liberal Democrats, but fundamentally, if people think that the police aren't going to come and look at their burglary, they're probably not going to return a Conservative government. But to do that, based on the fiscal situation we have, you need to do two things. One, you need to go really hard for growth. Now, the problem for the Conservatives especially, but I think to an extent for all parties, is that fundamentally there are two big levers you can pull to drive growth. One is a very liberal immigration system. People will have different views on that. I'm not necessarily saying that that's definitely the thing they should do, but, you know, it's one of the things you can do.
And the recent ONS forecasts showed that basically the only bit of growth there was, or was it, sorry, OBR, wasn't it? The figures came back that basically the only bit of growth in the autumn statement was coming from immigration.
Yeah, now, I'm not saying that's a magic bullet. You know, we have managed to combine historically high levels of immigration over the last 10 to 20 years with historically sluggish levels of growth. So it's not a magic bullet, but that's a thing you can do. The other thing you can do is you can build, right? You have houses primarily, but also infrastructure. You can do proper broadband infrastructure for the north of England to allow their businesses to compete. You can build lots of houses in the south so that southern workers can take home more of their pay and not lose it on rent, so they can spend it in the economy. And ultimately, Conservative voters in particular don't want either of those things to happen. And if you don't want either of those things to happen, you're not going to get growth. So if you're not going to get growth, then you really do have to start making hard decisions about actually cutting things. Now, that's not just shrinking budgets. I mean, actually deciding that in order to fund X properly, the state is no longer going to do Y. Now, I had a very interesting discussion with someone the other day where they posed me the question, we've heard a lot about austerity. The coalition did austerity after 2010. There's now talk of austerity 2.0. But after all of those cuts, what things has the government explicitly stopped doing? And it's not a very long list. There's like Sure Start centres, maybe EMA. You might be able to find one or two other things. I think they sold the Canal and River Trust. They spun off the canals and rivers into a charitable trust. But the government has never at any point made those hard decisions about, okay, we're going to properly fund the courts, the police, the welfare system. And to do that, we are going to stop doing other things. And so the Conservatives keep doing this. You know, the autumn statement, one, it absurdly pushed all of the cuts back to just after the next election. Now, there is no prospect of that prospectus being carried out. You know, the idea that the NHS would only grow by 1%, not going to happen, for example. But it was also, again, it's just making everything worse rather than making decisive strategic decisions. And why is that? Because ultimately, the current Conservative leadership, and that doesn't just mean Rishi Sunak, I think that means the broad intellectual leadership of the party, just doesn't know what it's trying to achieve. If they had a vision, if they had a final product, then they could go, okay, this, and this, they don't really fit in our vision of what the British government should be properly funding, and they'd cut it. And that might be popular, it might be unpopular, but it would free up money. But as that vision isn't there, they don't do any of that. And so instead, everything just keeps getting worse as the bill gets higher and higher and higher. It is completely unsustainable.
It does feel like it has got to an unsustainable point. And you can think Rishi Sunak is a impressive individual. I posed the question to you before, what is a Rishi Sunak government doing that is drastically different to what a Keir Starmer government were doing? There's very little I can think of in any meaningful way. It's a sort of pushing the deck chairs around the Titanic at this point, isn't it? The one thing I really want to talk to you about, because it's fascinating to hear it from a Conservative, is this issue of building, and particularly building houses. Now, Stephen Daisley on The Spectator wrote a fantastic, furious piece. You know, I didn't agree with everything, but I agreed with rather a lot of the substance of it, talking about, you know, basically saying younger people get out of here, go to Canada, go to Australia and have a lovely life. And it's a really powerful piece. I'll link to it in the show notes. And here's just a little bit of one paragraph. He wrote, not being especially bothered about social cohesion or economic dynamism, the Tories aren't troubled by such matters. What should trouble them is the political cost. A generation with nothing to conserve will have no reason to vote Conservative. Which I think if you are at any rank of the Conservative Party, and you're seeing a commentator in The Spectator write that, you should be terrified.
Oh yeah, and he's entirely right.
And he's entirely right, exactly.
Genuinely. Oh, go on. You go on. Finish
no, no. What I was going to say is, and a fundamental part of his argument, and a fundamental part of what you are arguing, and what I agree with, is that a lot of it is just, you know, things like not building houses. This, you know, we're recording this in a week where, again, there has been a Tory backbench rebellion on house building. With, you know, I heard, saw a quote from Therese Villiers complaining about, you know, housing targets and they were too great. And, you know, she has a particularly nice green leafy constituency. You know, what do these people think are going to happen if young people cannot afford a home under a Conservative government, if people do not see any, you know, growth in housing and a place they can live without, as you put it, you know, spending most of their money that they earn, which is increasingly, you know, being squeezed on rent?
Now, I have to be a little bit careful here, because whenever I actually try and pry into the souls of some of the Conservative MPs who are the most ardently against house building, I can be incredibly rude. So I don't want to speculate too much. I will say I've not actually seen all that much evidence that some of these MPs care or have an answer for what young people are supposed to do. You know, you actually debate them, and you know, some of them will say move to the north. That's actually something that you genuinely get Tory MPs saying. They're like, well, you know, you can afford a house in all sorts of other bits of the country, and the answer to that bluntly is yes, you can. The reason that those houses are so affordable is because of underinvestment by Westminster, in large part. Those areas are not particularly economically productive and there aren't all that many jobs there. You know, there's a reason that lots of young people have to uproot themselves and move to London, and it's because that's where the jobs are, which is why the housing market is so insane. And ultimately, you know, I do speak slightly from a selfish perspective. You know, I'm a man in his early 30s who is still living in a four-person house share. I'm on a decent professional income. And I'm currently in sort of the foothills of trying to buy a house, and it is utterly immiserating. The share, even this was before the mortgage market went haywire, just the share of my income it will cost me to have what would a generation ago have been a starter flat that you bought in your early 20s. And, you know, it adds up because there are all kinds of second order consequences of this, right? It delays people settling down and having families. It impacts their health. If, you know, if you don't have proper storage space, and this is something I've written about before, if you're crammed into a small house, you're not going to be buying in bulk and batch cooking. You're probably going to be shopping day to day or living off takeouts, all kinds of things. It infantilizes people. And there is, and genuinely, if somebody like me, who is not just demographically probably in the Conservatives' best under 65 bracket, but is also the deputy editor of a Conservative website, is there going, you know, why do you vote? You know, for me, it's I can't vote Labour because of the Gordon Brown constitutional vandalism that they're going to do. But for anyone else who doesn't particularly care about that, you know, it's a very good question. Why would you vote Conservative? And I think, again, this is a clear example of just the complete absence of strategic thinking. Because if you were the Conservatives, and especially if you were a Shire NIMBY, right, if you're living in the home counties or you're Bob Seeley in the Isle of Wight, you know, what's the most sensible thing you could possibly do to deliver housing and protect your constituency? It's a metropolitan planning bill. Literally, just do a bill for London. You draw it up with the government and you say, in the bounds of Greater London, we are basically tearing up the post-Attlee planning system. We're going to move to a zoning system. We're going to do all of this stuff, but it's only going to happen in London. Now, at a stroke, you will turbocharge the London economy. You will hugely improve the lives of people living here because there will be, you know, more places to live. But also, thinking selfishly as a Conservative MP, you will stop the process by which people who live and work in London and who vote like people who live and work in London end up having to live in the commuter belt. You know, you'll stop seats like Canterbury turning Labour. You'll stop the slow turn of seats like Brighton into turning Labour.
And or green.
That's an easy... Sorry?
Or green.
Yeah, or green. It's an easy win for the Conservatives if they had that sort of strategic ruthlessness. But instead of doing this... You know, there's what, 3-5 London marginals at this point? The Conservatives can ultimately govern without London if they have to for a while. But instead of doing this, we have London MPs like Theresa Villiers and Ian Duncan Smith at the forefront of the Conservative anti-housing movement. And it is absolutely ridiculous that so many Tory MPs are prepared to trade in the long-term prospects of the party let alone, you know, the hopes for home and family of a generation of young people, for the sake of giving Teresa Villas a five-year lease on Shipping Barnet. It is absolutely ridiculous.
You said you weren't going to get personal about MPs, but you've called out a few there, but I think you probably
It's very hard to have this debate and not reference a few of them. Like, I'm sorry, there are definitely people who are more culpable than others.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think you probably could have rattled off an even longer list had I wound you up even more, because, you know, the way this is done is truly destructive to a generation. And I think what I find fascinating about it, actually, is that... And your answer really articulates this, is there isn't really any long-term thinking, because there was always that old cliche, wasn't it, that young people vote Labour, then they grow up and vote for the Conservatives. But actually, if as you describe that kind of infantilization, you're never able to grow up, at least economically or in terms of family and relationships and whatever else, because you've been stuck in a multi-part person house share. If you're, or you feel like you lost your late 20s and early 30s because you couldn't do X, Y, Z for some of the reasons that you've articulated, actually, you're not going to get to 45, 50, 55 and go, actually, the people that did that to me for 15, 20 years are the people I should now vote for, are you? Because I've got out of it. Because A, you might not have got out of it, and B, you're going to remember it.
I mean, to an extent, I think a lot of voters who aren't particularly tuned into politics are generally, you know, mercenary enough, and I don't use that in a derogative sense, although it sounds like it, that once you're giving them a good deal, they will probably vote for you. It doesn't help, and definitely, you know, brand damage is a thing. I think the Conservatives after 1997 should remember how long it took them to rehabilitate the Conservative brand.
And what it took.
But the question is, at this point, when does it start working for you? Like genuinely,
exactly. That's really the core of my point.
Yeah, it's not just that it's getting later. You know, previously you'd have bought in your 20s, now you're going to buy in your 30s. But genuinely, so much of the wealth in this country is tied up in the older generation at this point. That when you talk about millennials, especially. You know, when a millennial is going to come into wealth? Well, the discussion is always focused around inheritances. Now, there are so many problems with this. Now, one is that's a way off. You know, frankly, we're living longer and healthier lives. So,
and no one wants to wish for the demise of their.
That was absolutely taken as read that everybody wishes. Most people wish long life for their parents. But also, it's not even guaranteed, because unless we do something about social care. Then there is genuinely the prospect that most of that money will just end up being consumed by care costs anyway. And for a lot of people, inheritance is their only shot in the current economic system. Inheritance is their only shot at owning a home, because house prices continue to grow and outpace wages. Mortgage costs are getting more expensive for many people. This is unfathomable that this is the case in this country, but it genuinely is the case. For many people, their only hope of coming into a home of their own is that they are left the means to do it by their parents.
Yeah.
And so that is not a sustainable model.
No, it cannot be. And it can't be a sustainable model for, I gave you that quote, didn't I? If there's nothing to conserve, you're not going to vote Conservative. I'll give you another quote and a figure that Stephen Daisley put in his article. And it was this, which I think just completely sums up your point. He says, in 1989, 51% of 25 to 34-year-olds owned their own home. Today, the figure is 28%.
Yeah, and it's...
Nothing more needs to be said, really. That just sort of hits the nail on the head, doesn't it?
Well, no, again, I've got some personal experience of this. So, you know, I'm currently looking vaguely to try and buy. And, you know, I'm talking to my uncle. Who lovely man who's been helping me out with the process. And it's weird that the complete just disjunction of experience, because to him, this is my first flat. And so he's giving me a lot of the advice that he was given when he was buying his first flat. And, you know, he'd be like, you know, you don't need to love it. It's your first place. You'll only be in there for a little while, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And all of this was probably excellent advice when you were buying in your early 20s and, you know, you're expecting to be there for a few years and then maybe you'd move on. But genuinely, I think for someone who is, you know, in their 30s or later, who is at the age when they would, you know, quite like to have a depending on your circumstances, you know, with family. But even then, just a nice place of your own. And the fact is that even if you can afford to get on the housing ladder, there is a big gap between being able to afford something and being able to afford something nice. And again, politically speaking, that matters. And it might not, and it might not show up in the overall ownership statistics. But if you've got someone who has mortgaged themselves to the hilt in order to buy what is just they don't think is a particularly nice flat or house, then that is, again, they're not going to thank the government for that. They're not going to be thinking, oh, thank you, Rishi Sunak, for helping me get on the housing ladder. They're going to be thinking, I am throwing so much of my income at this, which is not really worth this in a healthy economy.
You mentioned earlier this idea that so much of wealth is tied up in, you know, generation or two above us, you know, our parents and grandparents' generation. And Emma and I, we were talking about this last week. We didn't get on to the kind of triple lock issues that came up of pensions that came up in the autumn statement. Now, that was brought in by the coalition, wasn't it? It may even have been a sort of thing pushed by the Lib Dems, if I'm remembering rightly. It was certainly taken up very gladly by the Conservatives and one of the things both parties agreed on, the triple lock. But actually now, it just feels grotesque, doesn't it? I think I saw a stat, and I'm happy to be corrected on this, that basically a third of pensioners are millionaires. Now, I assume that is not cash millionaires, that is in assets, basically because their houses are worth over £1 million. But that just feels grotesque, that more and more from our generation is going to protect, very well-off people in to a generation or two above us. Now, there are some very, very, very vulnerable pensioners that as a society we should all be contributing to looking after. That goes almost without saying. But there are also some issues of constantly taking from one generation to protect another, whilst that the generation you're taking from is never going to have the benefits of those older than them.
I mean, absolutely. And there are all sorts of points you could make about this. You know, the generation currently benefiting from the triple lock back when they were my age voted for the government that cut pensions for the previous generation. But yeah, there's this outdated idea that pensioners are a particularly badly off group in our society. And the triple lock was originally intended to be a means of addressing that. And in fairness, in that terms, it's been an incredibly successful policy. But I think really, you're right. It is grossly unfair that more and more usurious taxes and cost of living burdens are being heaped on working age people in order to fund this generational wealth transfer upwards. And, you know, especially if you're a graduate on plan two of the tuition fee, I can't remember the exact figure, but I think if you pay the higher rate of tuition fees, then as a worker aged about 25, you're paying an absolutely ridiculous marginal tax rate on your income. But I think actually the case against the triple lock can be made relatively simply and without reference to that. It's just the way the triple lock operates is that it guarantees that pensions will grow faster than wages forever. Now, I think there is a case, there's definitely a case for index linking, you know, having a single lock to make sure that inflation doesn't erode the state pension. I think that's a completely reasonable protection. But I really don't think, and I've certainly never heard a persuasive case for why overall pensions should be legally guaranteed to outgrow wages. And that is all really that the triple lock is in its own terms. So yes, as you say, targeted support for the less well-off, absolutely. But general provision to people who can afford to go without it, and this is where I think I might differ from some of your listeners on the left, is I think we can apply this principle more broadly. I think we have a general problem in that in many areas of life we are fixated on trying to provide things universally when, given spiraling costs and already historically high tax take, we should be focusing limited public money more effectively on the people who need it the most. You know, there was this row the other day about Rishi Sunak using private healthcare, for example.
That a row, or was that just a very deeply unimpressive? I mean, Pippa Crerar is a brilliant journalist. I thought that was one of her least impressive stories for a long time, that Rishi Sunak is registered with a private GP.
Yes, I mean, okay, well, we can call it a drive-by shooting or whatever you want to call it. Maybe it wasn't a row. But I think that there is a general, you know, in most systems, and I'm not talking about, you know, the great dystopian American system, but in most European universal provision systems, people with a bit more money are expected to chip in a bit more for their healthcare. And that allows the transfer of money, you know, to the least well-off. In a And instead, there's this genuine political fixation amongst parts of the electorate and parts of politics about maintaining the purity of these universal systems, even when it means that, A, those systems aren't very good, and B, a substantial chunk of those systems is basically about funneling money towards people who don't actually need that support. So this is a this is a big problem. It actually transcends the Conservatives. I've been very critical of the Conservatives. I think you said earlier it's hard to see the difference, real differences between what a Sunak government and a Starmer government would do. I think that's an indictment of Starmer. I think that on both sides, really, there is a complete absence of the willingness to confront the fact that a lot of the things that we, that I say we, that historically we have cherished most about the way we do things, and that includes the triple lock. I also think, bluntly, it includes things like the way that we fund and operate the NHS, are simply not working. They are not delivering good services. They are not delivering cost-effective services, and they are contributing to a system where basically everybody is poor and receiving bad care. Now, one party or the other, at some point, will have to confront this. But the unfortunate fact is that doing that is going to make them very unpopular with a substantial and currently very powerful group of the electorate who are doing perfectly fine, thank you, and are either unwilling or unable to accept that a system which seems to be working for them is not working for everyone else.
Yeah, I mean, I could have a whole different show on the what I think the political opportunity for the Lib Dems could and should be, but that would be a whole different show. Perhaps we'll do it another time. I want to end just very briefly on a slightly more positive note. I've been cross for 2 weeks in a row on this show. And so I want to end a little bit more positively. Do you think there is a way, never mind what the electoral prospects for one party or the other are, do you think there is a way that in 6, 12, 18 months, this government that will presumably remain in power now until the next election in 2024 can make Britain feel and actually be better?
I mean, of course they could. In theory, they have an 80-seat majority. And also, as we saw today, there is always the possibility of collaborating with Labour in order to get some things through. You know, Lisa Nandy today saying that that Labour could help defeat Theresa Villa's and pass the housing amendment, for example, I think is very worthwhile. Actually, an outgoing government that knows it's going to lose, but nonetheless has a substantial majority, could do a lot of good, right? Like, imagine if Michael Gove, say, called in the Abingdon Reservoir and just said, yes, it's ridiculous that this part of the country has been having annual water shortages for 20 years. We're just going to build this. Imagine if the government just started approving things, knowing it was going to lose the election. It just started calling stuff in and getting stuff approved and built. Would that pay off immediately? No, I'm not entirely sure there are 6-month solutions to some of these problems, unfortunately. And I think chasing them would be counterproductive. But I definitely think that given 2 years, the Conservatives and certain ministers especially could do things which in 5 or 10 years' time, when they've paid off, when they've been built, would give them a legacy that they could be proud of. Whether they'll do it is a different question.
Well, no doubt you and your colleagues at Conservative Home will be covering it all extensively. Henry, thank you so much for joining me. Where can people keep up with you and your work?
I'm on Twitter, inevitably, as everyone is. But otherwise, you know, conservativehome.com. Is where we do our daily sort of in-depth coverage of the Conservative Party. And then I write for The Guardian and various other places. So Google me. And once you've waded through all the entries about the gangster, you'll find me.
Well, thank you for not being a gangster on this show. I'm at Charlotte A. Henry on Twitter. I also write the Edition newsletter over on Substack. So do join me there. And Emma and I will see you next week.